Are you a real estate investor looking to sharpen your skills?
Or a newbie looking to become one?
You're in the right place. Welcome to Where Should I Invest? Real Estate Investing in Canada with your host, Sarah Larby.
Hey everybody, it's Sarah Larby here and you are listening to Where Should I Invest? Real Estate Investing in Canada. And this is show number 7. So today my guest is Michael Dominichetti, who started investing in real estate actually at the age of 10 when he was helping his dad, started flipping some homes and managed their family properties. He had about, his father had about 10 to 14 doors, and into his 20s, managed several other homes, and then started into, I think he was 21 years old when he bought his first property. Some of the really cool things that you guys will hear about today is that Michael ended up flipping a fire-burned house, and we'll talk about that process. And he also built his own family home in 2015 with a basement apartment. He is also a real estate licensed professional. He's a realtor working with a lot of investors in the Hamilton, Grimsby, Waterdown area, a little bit in Burlington as well. So really, really excited about our guest today. Also, if you wanted to reach out to me, you can always email me at saralarby@hotmail.com. That is my direct email address. And if you have any questions or comments, or maybe you want to be a guest on the show, reach out to me and we can definitely talk. The other thing I want to mention is networking is so important. And some of you guys probably know this, but I am a co-founder of the SoBright Investing Club, and that is the Southern Ontario Real Estate Investing Training Club, where like-minded individuals get together and it's just purely knowledge sharing and knowledge base. So we actually host monthly meetings once a month. Right now we have about 100 guests every time showing up. This is in Burlington, and we've got a great event coming up November 18th. That's a full day event and it's about multifamily and everything you need to know about it. And then we have another event January 17th. But if you guys want to check us out, there is a Facebook page. And if you search SoBright Club, S-O space R-E-I-T Club, you should be able to find us and you can always reach out to me on that as well. So with that said, let's get on with the show. And I'm really, really excited about today's episode with Michael Dominichetti.
Hello, Michael.
Hey, Sarah, how are you?
Great. Really excited to have you here on our show.
I'm really excited to be here.
And I think a lot of our investors and our listeners will be able to gain a lot of new information and knowledge from your experience.
So, yeah, let's hope so. I'm excited to share.
Excellent. So would you be able to let our listeners know a little bit about your background and how you got started into real estate investing?
Yeah, absolutely. So I say to people that my investment career in real estate started when I was about 10 years old. And my father was purchasing homes to flip and some rental properties as well. When I was about 10, I would rush home from school and eat down my supper really quickly and jump in my dad's truck and head to one of his projects and spend my nights and weekends pulling wire and doing drywall and all that kind of fun stuff.
You got exposed to it quite young.
Very early. And I also found out, too, that when my grandparents came over to Canada from Italy, they purchased a very large house and they rented out rooms. They basically were operating their house as a boarding room. Oh, I was having a great time.
Good. You've also helped them manage some of the rental properties?
Yeah, so my dad's path into real estate started with flipping homes because he didn't have a lot of money to hold them at that point. So he started off by flipping 3 or 4 homes, using that capital to then buy homes to hold and then grow his portfolio from there. By the time I was a teenager and had my driver's license, he had about 14 doors that he was self-managing.
Wow. So talk to me about your first one. Like, how did you decide to say, I'm going to pull the trigger and get my very own property?
Well, I think I saw all the benefits of owning real estate through what my family was doing. And it was just second nature to me, because I'd been around it for so long. It's like, you know, you wake up in the morning and you brush your teeth just because it's a habit. For me, real estate kind of felt the same way because I'd been around it for so long.
So you started at what age, if you don't mind me asking?
So the first house I ever bought, I actually purchased with my sister when I was 26.
Okay.
And again, very unique opportunity. We bought a house and we renovated it into a two-family home. Mm-hmm. Where she lived upstairs and I lived downstairs. And then from there, I ended up selling my half to her. And then I was able to use that money to start my real estate investing.
That's great. I think you being a realtor, so you're a realtor currently, and having that information and that background helps your investors quite a bit.
Oh, absolutely. Well, even my clients within real estate, too, I know they rely on my background in construction and renovation quite a lot, because it's not common for people to have that kind of experience.
That's right. So since you started in real estate, started flipping, acquiring properties, can you walk us through some of the deals, what your portfolio looks like right now?
Sure. Let's see. Going back to about 11 or 12 years ago now, we flipped a duplex in Hamilton, and that was a house that we picked up at the time for $90,000, which was pretty amazing. And in today's market, that's completely unheard of in the mm-hmm. Hamilton market. So we spent about 4 months there completely renovating two bathrooms, two kitchens, windows, furnace. It was a tremendous amount of structural work inside the house because it needed all new plumbing, wiring, a lot of expensive mechanical stuff. At the end of the day, though, that project, we ended up netting, it was about 15%. That's typically what we look for on the projects that we do. So that was one of the first ones that I did. And then the next one shortly after that, we purchased a house that had a major fire in it.
Yeah, so talk to me more about that. That sounds really interesting. A lot of investors probably shy away from such a such a project.
It was a massive project because there was a lot of engineering involved in that one. We basically had to reverse engineer the house because we kept the outside structure and the roof, and then we mm-hmm. had to gut the entire inside of the house, including a lot of the structural walls, and rebuild it from the ground up. So that was a really interesting project. I learned a tremendous amount about the engineering side of things, as well as working with the city and a lot of our contractors and helping to guide them through the process, because it's not very often that you have a project like that where you have to half demolish the house but not wholly demolish the house and kind of reverse engineer and rework things to build it up that way.
So that's quite interesting, and I've never dealt with this kind of project. How, you know, can you walk the investors or listeners a little bit through some of the steps and what you had to do and maybe the time frame for all those steps?
Sure. We took possession of that particular project between Christmas and New Year's, and we bought it directly from the owner who, you know, unfortunately had the fire in the house, and his decision was just to take the insurance money and not rebuild and just walk away and sell the house for land value. So we were able to pick up that piece of land fairly cheap. It was a really good project from that side of things. And then we started out right away with engineering. We had to bring in structural engineers, all of our contractors, to figure out exactly where they were even going to start with this. And then once we got through the engineering part of things, it was like peeling back an onion. Because when a fire happens in a house, there's a lot of stuff that happens in behind the walls and under the floors that you can't see. And until you start peeling off the drywall and peeling up the floors and things like that, you don't really know the extent of the damage. So, you know, once we were able to start peeling back those layers, we had to call back the engineer two and three times, because every time we peeled back a layer, we discovered more structural issues.
Well,
and then once that was done, we had to get a complete set of drawings. And then from that point, it was pretty similar to new construction that you have to go to the city and get a building permit. You have to have your licensed contractors in and have the city come in and sign off through all those step points of signing off after the roughing is done. Then you get your insulation done, and they have to sign off on that. And then you do all your next build-out steps from there.
So how long was the project from start to finish?
Start to finish was 6 months.
Is that what you had estimated going into it?
We figured it was going to be about 6 months, because new home construction for Most production-built houses are built in 4 to 5 months. Custom homes can be anywhere from 6 to 8 months to even a year and beyond, depending on the complexity. So we kind of gauged it based on it being like a custom build and figured it would be about a six-month project.
So that's good. So if there's another fire-burnt house, would you take it and try to redo something that's similar like you did in the past?
Absolutely. I wouldn't hesitate.
So as an investor, what would be some of the top two or three things to really watch out for before putting in an offer in a house like that?
I would say in a fire burned out house like that, even if it looks like it's a minor fire, assume probably 50% more than what you can visually see.
Okay.
Because, like I said, the fire, it gets into all these little nooks and crannies that you can't even see, and it does a tremendous amount of damage. So I would say that's probably the number one thing. Number two is, like any flip-type project, is you make your money when you go in, when you buy.
Right.
You've got to be really careful about and realistic about what your rental costs are going to be and make sure you stick to that budget.
I know that you mentioned you built your own family home back in 2015. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, that was a really interesting project because we don't like to do anything really easy. So we actually bought the land where we built our house 10 years ago. It had a little tiny bungalow on a half acre lot, and we always knew that we were going to do something with the land. We weren't sure if it was a second story addition or maybe an addition out the back or just tear it down and start over. So while we were in the planning stages of all this, our neighbor that was immediately next to our property severed off a portion of her lot that was adjoining our property. So we ended up buying that piece of land that she had severed off. And then we ultimately ended up moving the house that we were living in from where we were to the vacant lot next door, which then freed up our property to do whatever we wanted with.
So definitely a lot of thinking outside the box.
I think that's where my family and I really excel is looking at things from a multitude of different angles and figuring out really what the best opportunity is of the situation.
So do you consider yourself a flipper, a buy and hold investor, a mix? What kind of investing do you like to do most and what do you consider yourself?
Yeah, I would say my history has shown that we've done mostly flips. And I think part of that has to do with this rush that I get from finding a property that I can see the potential in and being able to take that vision and turn it into something.
Are you helping your investors find these types of properties? And if so, what are you looking for right now with them?
Yeah, every investor has their own little set of goals, whether it's to flip homes for today cash or do a buy, flip, hold. We have a range of people that we're working with. And what I've learned is it's really important for me to ask a lot of really good questions to really understand what their goal is. Because I'll have people ask me, you know, I want to flip a house. Okay, well, that's great. I can find you a house to flip and you can make a few bucks on it. Why is it that you're going to flip a house? You know, do you realistically have the time available to be able to do this? Do you have all the skills? Do you have the capacity to be able to manage a project like that? I'd like people to really dig deep and be realistic about their situation. And it's important for me to understand exactly what their goal is.
Yeah, absolutely. Are you able to talk about any specific types of properties that you've been able to find recently?
Sure. Yeah. I know of one right now that's really interesting. Young lady purchased the property and she started to do the demolition on it, and I don't know the exact reason why she's pulling the plug on it. However, she's done a lot of the major lifting as far as the demolition is concerned, and she's decided that she doesn't want to see it to completion. So there's lots of opportunities out like that out there.
So before you were a realtor, were you buying all of your deals on MLS?
I have a little bit of an advantage there because my father was a realtor as well.
Okay.
However, that being said, the bulk of the projects that we did ourselves were deals that we found not on the MLS.
How did you find them?
It's always through referrals.
Okay.
And just having conversations with people and letting them know what we're up to.
Have you ever posted any of those I buy houses ads?
You know, we've not done that. And I know people that have, and they've had good success in doing that. I still find that the most important thing is being face-to-face with people.
Mm-hmm.
Whether it's looking for flips or just within my own business, the number one thing is to have those conversations with people, however you need to make that happen. Whether it's door knocking a neighborhood where you know that there's those kinds of projects available, or networking with people at investment groups, or whatever, even just talking to your family at Christmas dinner, you'd be surprised the information that you can find out by just being intentional about it.
That's a great point, actually. I was working for my mom one evening, and one of her customers ended up owning a sixplex, so we're in discussions right now. It wouldn't have happened unless I said, you know, here's, you know, my favorite pastime, buying houses, something. Buying properties. So, yeah, I mean, it might be a little bit of a longer process, but yeah, you got to always be telling people about what you're doing, and that's how opportunities come about. Clearly, there's still MLS and there's different things, but word of mouth, 100% agree with you there.
Oh, absolutely.
What are you doing right now? Like, what are you working on these days?
A couple of things. We're still finishing off the build of our own house, which is kind of interesting too, because the only reason why we were able to move on with building our house is because we built it with a 2-bedroom basement apartment. So even my own personal residence, we decided to have something there to help offset our costs.
Yeah, that's very smart. I mean, why pay if you can have somebody else pay for you?
Exactly. So we've got that on the go, and we picked up about 6 or 7 weeks ago now a property here close to where I live. We bought a 3-bedroom semi that we're in the process of flipping.
That's great. Mm-hmm. So where in the process are you right now?
Well, the house is 90% gutted, and not gutted, but the demolition side of things is done. And we are just getting all of our materials sourced and ordered so that we can start putting the house back together here in the next couple of weeks.
Now, I personally go to Home Depot, but do you know of any better places to source materials from?
One of the benefits that we have, I think, is because we've been doing this for so long, we have some corporate accounts with a variety of different vendors. Mm-hmm. And I find a lot of the corporate accounts that we have, we get really, really good deals on.
Okay. So these are corporate accounts through what, places like Home Depot or different?
Yeah, a lot of these are larger wholesaler type places. So for plumbing supplies, there's a place in Burlington that we go to, Mark's mm-hmm. Plumbing, and electrical supply. I'm trying to remember the name of the place. There's a couple around, like Jerry Electric. Once you have a corporate account with those kinds of people, they usually offer you some pretty good terms.
So as an investor, like, how do you go ahead and get a corporate account set up?
I believe every company is going to be slightly different. They're going to look at your credit for sure. It's just like you're applying for any other kind of credit card. So you're going to want to have all your ducks in a row. If you're applying personally, you want to have all your like T4s and notice of assessments and all that kind of stuff available. If you have a corporation, they're going to want all the supporting documents for the corporation. I find it's a bit of a snowball effect. Once you get the first one, then you can use the first one as a reference to get the second one, third one, and fourth one. Once you have a corporation, getting that first credit account, it's kind of a big deal.
Now, when you're doing a flip, like your flip right now, you're probably, and correct me if I'm wrong, but you're looking at, you know, the cost of the reno, the after repair value, and that kind of stuff. Are you able to walk our listeners through how you look at those numbers?
Sure. There's a couple of levels that we go through when we're evaluating any kind of a project. And this even goes too for looking at larger properties like the multifamily, you know, 3-unit, 6-unit, 10-unit buildings. There's always that sort of high level where you do your rough numbers and say, okay, well, if I can buy this house for 500 grand and it's going to take me about 50K to do the renos, and I'm going to have about 10K in costs, and then I've got to factor in real estate fees and lawyer's fees and all the other stuff. And I want to look at usually 15% is kind of our bar for doing any kind of a flip project. If it's less than 15%, there's got to be some other pretty big factors involved for us to take a look at it.
Have you ever had any properties that you've tried to flip that you didn't get those numbers?
The one that we're working on right now, the numbers are pretty tight. Like we're having to be very, very careful about our budget. There's no room for error when it comes to the budget on this one.
Was there a specific reason why you decided to go ahead with it?
A couple of reasons. We had the money available, and the property is less than 5 minutes from my own personal house, so it's really easy for me to keep an eye on it.
Mm-hmm.
And the other thing, too, because it's an area that I do a lot of work in as a realtor, it's also a really good listing for me to have as a realtor, so there's also that side of it as well. That for me, that was the point that actually tipped the scales.
You can give yourself the listing and and make some good deals that way.
Oh, it's always good to have signs on the ground when you're in the real estate business.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. So where exactly are you a realtor? Like, what areas do you look at and what areas do you cover?
I've learned very quickly that I need to stay inside my area of expertise. And I think it's like anything else in life. In order to do anything really, really well, you have to be focused. So I've realized I do really well inside the greater Hamilton area, like Hamilton, Stoney Creek, Ancaster, Dundas, and Waterdown where I live. And I grew up in Burlington, so I know Burlington really well. So that's my focus area for real estate.
So the title of my podcast is Where Should I Invest? Are you able to give us any insights on any of those regions that we may not be able to easily find through Google? Any inside knowledge on the regions that you can provide?
Yeah, I can tell you from experience with the investors that I've been working with for years now, having conversations with them and just relaying what they're seeing as well. And, you know, Hamilton is still a good place to invest. There's still great opportunities to do flips. There's still great opportunities to buy multifamilies, even single family rental properties. There's still good opportunities there. However, we're seeing a lot of the investors starting to shift their attention to some of the areas like Brantford,
mm-hmm.
As well as the Niagara region.
Yeah, I have noticed people in Brantford a lot more. And I think Hamilton is much higher in terms of price. So yes, there's now multiple bidders on one house and much more than there used to be before, but prices are still fairly low. And I have noticed St. Catharines as well.
I was going to say St. Catharines, a lot of people are shifting their attention out that way in particular.
So why do you think that's the case?
I think there's a couple of reasons. Number one, the GO train. They just made a major announcement last week with the exact location of the stops of the GO train right through to Niagara. Grimsby, kind of around that 50-point area. I know it's following the Via Rail line right through into Niagara Falls. And they had a stop in St. Catharines as well.
Yes.
So I think because of that, it's. I mean, that's one of the things that I learned a long time ago is you follow the transit when it comes to investing.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, if you can buy 800 meters or less from a transit stop, the GO train stop, you are going to find it a lot easier to find tenants, to get a premium rent, and the houses can appreciate faster than if you could walk to it. I mean, it's going to appreciate faster than if you've got to drive over to the subway stations or the bus stations or the train stations.
Mm-hmm. We've seen it happen in Hamilton in the last few years. As soon as they announced that the GO train was going to be stopping at the Center Mall area in East Hamilton, I mean, the prices just went through the roof.
So what are you finding your investors right now in Hamilton, in Stoney Creek? Like, what are some of the prices that we can expect?
Hamilton has changed quite a bit in the last 6 months with the change in the marketplace. I know a lot of investors that when the prices really were escalating quickly back in the springtime, they just said, yeah, we're going to hang on and see how this all plays out. Because for them to go into competition to buy a home as a rental, the numbers just weren't making sense anymore. And now that that's kind of subsided, the investors are starting to come back out of the woodwork a little bit and saying, okay, we don't have to go into competition to buy houses. We can take our time, do our proper due diligence, and make sure that we're buying the right homes in the right areas.
If I wanted to buy a flip property in Hamilton, like, are there areas that you would recommend over others?
I'm a really big fan of East Hamilton. East of Kenilworth, it's just a great area. You get these nice little homes that are, for the most part, all brick. They're on nice-sized lots. Quite a few of them have parking. The school district is nice. There's lots of parks nearby. very easy access to the Red Hill Express, which connects you pretty much anywhere you want to go. Yeah, there's just a lot of really good factors there. And I personally think that the Ottawa Street section, which has been growing over the last few years, is really going to take off in the next 5 years.
With the new stress test, how is that going to affect the market? What's your opinion on that?
I think right now one of the biggest challenges is education, because, you know, the government makes these announcements and quite often it freaks people out because they don't fully understand how it's going to have an effect directly to them. So what had happened about a year ago is the government came out with a stress test for anybody who was putting less than 5% down. And they said, if you're putting less than 5% down on a house, you've got to qualify at the posted rate, not the discounted rate. So we saw a very, very small effect at that time, because most of the people that are putting 5% or less down on a house are the first time buyers in the market. So it changes their affordability by about 15 to 20% at that time. And then the government came down recently and said, okay, we're going to apply the stress test to everybody. And I understand where they're coming from. So what it means is that even if you are selling a home and you're buying a next home and you've got, say, $200,000 in equity, you still have to qualify at the posted rate, which is about 4.5%, versus the discounted rate where the bank may give you, say, 3% for your financing. So what it's doing is it's shifting people's affordability back. And as far as investors are concerned, I don't know that it's going to have much of an effect on the investors directly from them purchasing a home. I think where you're going to see it have a bit of an effect is when they're selling a home, depending on what price point that they're at in the market. I don't know if that helps clear it up or make it more complicated. I think the biggest effect that we're going to see because of that particular rule change with the stress test is going to be the homes that are priced at the high end of the market. And I think we've already seen that a little bit in areas like Burlington and Oakville, where the homes can sell quite easily for $1 million plus. So the people that could afford $1 million are now going to be able to afford $800,000. And that is a very different house at that price point.
Yeah, it is. And then I think it could be a good buying opportunity for investors. And as people are kind of waiting on the sidelines, wondering what's going to happen, hopefully it'll allow us to not have as many bidding wars potentially.
Well, and it's really interesting right now because the people that I'm talking to, it seems there's two schools of thought. There's either people that say, I want to buy a house now before the stress test has an effect on me. So they're rushing to the market to buy before the end of the year. And other people are saying, well, I think there's going to be a bit of a deflation of the marketplace, so I'm going to wait until after January and maybe I can pick up that house a little bit cheaper if I wait.
Or if you're a cash flow investor like me, it doesn't matter because the rents aren't going anywhere and you'll still make money either way. So
I think regardless of what happens with the rule changes, the economy is going to always keep moving forward.
Absolutely. Yeah, I mean, 10 years from now, people look at it and said, I wish I bought more 10 years ago with 10 years from now.
I could not agree more, Sarah. If you look at the history of real estate from 1955 to today in the Burlington-Hamilton area, it has pretty consistently increased by doubling in price about every 12 years.
I believe that. Yep, absolutely.
And there's only one time that I have and the information that I have as far as the history of the area that shows that the average price actually went backwards, and it was for about 6 years in the mid-90s. Even at that, like peak in 1992, the average house price was around 160, and 3 years later, it was down to about 140. So, yeah, it went backwards for a few years. It wasn't like the prices got cut in half.
No, that's a minor blip in the system.
Exactly.
There's a lot of people waiting, I think, on the sidelines and hoping that there's going to be this crash that's going to happen. And when you really look at the fundamentals and you look at, you know, immigration, you look at different things like that, I don't think we're going to see this crash. People are going to be waiting on the sidelines. If it goes down 10%, maybe they'll still be waiting on the sidelines because they're going to think it goes another 10% or 20% down and they're going to miss the boat and it'll go back up before you know it.
Exactly. And you know what? It's really basic supply and demand economics at work when it comes to the housing market. And in the what they call the Greater Toronto Hamilton area, the GTHA, right now there's about 9.5 million people. And they're forecasting that in the next 10 to 12 years, we're going to be at 12.5 million people here. So you're talking about a population increase of almost 25% in the next like 12 to 15 years. Where are those people going to live?
That's my question exactly. They're going to have to live somewhere.
Well, and if you look at like geographically how we're set up, from like Toronto is basically full. You can't build anything else of volume right. in Toronto.
You got the green belt and everything around it.
Yeah, you got the green belt to the north. You've got the lake to the south. I mean, if you're from Burlington, the lake is to the south. And basically, like Mississauga's full, Oakville's pretty much full, Burlington's pretty much full. So the pressure just keeps getting pushed farther and farther west, which is why I think these areas like Hamilton, Grimsby, Stony Creek, St. Catharines, Brantford, they are just going to have more pressure applied to them in the next 10 years.
What's the next chapter for you?
My goal with my wife for our family is to start buying and holding properties. We actually ended up liquidating a lot of our stuff to pull off this house build and everything that we've done in the last few years. So that's our path starting in 2018 once this flip house is done that we're working on, is to focus our energy on purchasing properties that we can buy and hold so that we're working on a 10-year plan.
Excellent.
So everything we're doing now is focusing on where we're going to land in 10 years, because that's about when our kids are going to be going to university.
Investing rather than our ESPs, in my opinion, buying properties, I think you'd be much further ahead than buying a house, putting even an 18-year mortgage on it by the time that, you know, they're 0 to 18 as an example. They've got a house that they can use to pay for university. They can keep it. They can rent it. They can sell it. I mean, I actually think that's a great idea. Well, I know there's a few people that do that. They buy houses for their kids. It's a great education plan.
Absolutely. A friend of mine actually did that. And he's now at year 12. And he purchased his first property as a triplex. And about a year later, purchased his second property, which was a triplex as well. And then he bought the family home that he's living in. So fast forward 12 years, he is now mortgage-free in his own personal house. His one rental property is mortgage-free, and the second rental property has about a $300,000 mortgage, and he's sitting on about $1.6 to $1.7 million worth of real estate.
That's great. That's great. I mean, I wish more people knew of these types of strategies.
Yeah, and I don't want to glamorize it and say all he did was write a check and did nothing for the next 12 years.
Right.
Because he worked his butt off with those properties to renovate them and make them a really nice place for people to live, manage them properly, make sure he's got good tenants in there. It's been a lot of work. However, 12 years later, and he's got north of $1 million worth of equity in three properties.
Amazing. Good for him.
How can you save that much money investing in anything else?
You just can't. I mean, I look at what we've been able to do in 5 years, and we like had nothing. Like, not even that long ago, we had nothing. And now we look at our portfolio and our overall income from the properties and then our equity, and we would have never saved that ever.
Mm-hmm. So I'm curious, and I like mm-hmm. asking this question of people that buy and hold properties, because I think that the first 24 months are probably the most challenging. Did you find that to be true?
So, I mean, a lot of the houses that I've bought in Brantford were fairly turnkey in the sense that they didn't need a whole lot of renos. And you've got the regular maybe $3,000 or $4,000 that you've got to put into the house before the tenants move in, just to paint and whatever else you got to do. Mm-hmm. But I've found that the first 6 months you're recouping your costs, but not necessarily 24 months. And maybe it's just the types of properties that I have bought in the past. And Brantford, when I was buying the properties at $165,000 or even this last one at $238,000, they don't need too much work. And there's a lot of demand for tenants out there, very, very low supply. So yes, you've got the odd repair, this and that, but I would say within 6 months, it was, again, you know, you've always got calls of broken fridges or whatever, but you can stabilize them fairly quickly for what I'm doing in terms of single family properties.
That makes sense. Well, and I think for people that are new to that kind of investing too, the first one, there's so many things to learn, especially on the first one. And then when you get the second one, the learning curve gets shortened a little bit. And by the time you get to the third and the fourth one, the learning curve is fairly quick.
Absolutely. One of the things that I did with even the last one, you don't need to wait until you close on the house to find a tenant. So usually when I buy a house, I don't know if your investors do that, but you ask for showings and then you use your showings to bring families through, you know, within a 2-hour gap, maybe you have 10 families come through. And I've done that in the last couple and found that I was able to place the tenants and sign the lease and everything before I even closed on the house. So within a week of having to do some small updates and upkeep on the property, they were able to move in. And there's no reason why anybody should have to wait a whole month to, in between the time that they sign the agreement to the time that they close, and then a whole month afterwards, because you're going to probably be showing the property. Tenants need to give, hopefully the tenants that you get are reasonable enough to give 60 days. So you're probably looking at 90 days before you sell it. So it's so much easier to do it right away. And Kijiji is amazing. And we've found some of our tenants even prior to finding houses, and we've had them lined up. So there's definitely lots of things that you can do that way.
You know what? That's a great point. And we've done this in the past too, where we have an investor that's looking at purchasing a particular property, but there's a question about what the rentability is going to be. And you know what? Put a Kijiji out there.
For sure. I put lots of feelers out there, and you know what you'll get as well, which is really cool. And I've actually bought a house this way. You put a feeler if you're not too sure about the intersection and then how much it's going to rent. And then you're going to get the replies. And some of them will say, you know, my landlord is selling and I need to move. And sometimes you're actually going to buy their house. It's actually a true story. It happened to me. And I said, well, what house are you living in? And maybe I'm interested in it. And I ended up buying it and the tenant stayed there. So through a feeler.
That's awesome.
Yeah, so there's lots of things that we can do. It's just think outside the box.
Thinking outside the box.
Time is one of the most valuable assets, and don't waste it. Yeah, no, it's good. I'm excited that you're getting into the buy and holds as well. I am kind of flipping one of my properties right now, and I could have used some of your expertise to make things go even smoother, but I think overall it'll turn out well.
You know, it's funny how when you do something for so long, like when we bought this house a couple of months ago, there was no hesitation on my part to buy this property, because you just do it so much and you have that high level of comfort. And because it's been a little while since we purchased a property to have as a rental, there's a certain amount of, I don't know if I would call it fear, but just like there's some variables there that I need to really pay attention to make sure that we're doing the right thing.
Absolutely.
Just being really clear about what the rentability of the house is. And I'm a big fan of whatever you do, start with the end in mind. So even when looking at a rental property, is figuring out what your tenant profile look like.
Right?
Like, am I buying a house because I'm looking for a family to move into it? Or is it going to be for students or, you know, a young couple, professional? And then figuring out, okay, those are the people that I can connect with. I know I'm going to get good rents. They're stable tenants, all that kind of stuff. And then, okay, what kind of homes are they looking for? And then go find that property.
Yeah, that's great advice. Awesome. All right, so let's move into our next part of the show, which is actually our lightning round. So this is where I will ask you a series of questions, and you're going to give it some short answers. You can elaborate a little bit. But they're meant to be some quick responses.
Okay, I'm ready.
Got it? All right, perfect.
Fire away.
So number one, what is your favorite real estate book?
Favorite real estate book? It's got to be Rich Dad, Poor Dad.
Excellent, excellent. I think everybody from the show so far has said that book, but it is a great book.
You know what it was? It was the cash flow quadrant. That was just like mind-blowing for me.
Absolutely. It changes their mindset completely.
Yes.
Do you listen to podcasts?
Something I'm getting into currently, yes.
Do you have a favorite one?
You know what? Actually, a friend of mine, he's a colleague. His name's Sandy McKay, and he runs a really great podcast about real estate investing. And
absolutely.
I've been listening to that a little bit lately.
I think that's a Breakthrough Real Estate Investing.
That's the one.
I like that one as well. It's a great one. What about your favorite pastime? So when you're not working on your real estate business, when you're not working on your flipping business, what do you do?
That'd be my kids. My kids are 5.5 and 7, and this is why I do what I do. It's for them.
Excellent. And if you lost all your money tomorrow and all of your assets, how would you start again?
I would start by doing some JVs with people because I have the knowledge. And if I don't have the money, then I would find people that have the money and partner with them. Start building up the portfolio again with that method and then just grow it from there.
Perfect. So if somebody came to you with $50,000 and wanted to get started, what would you tell them?
I would start asking them a lot of questions. What's your goal? What's your end goal? Right? Like, do you need money today or do you want to grow this $50,000 into something huge 10 years from now?
And where can listeners find you if they wanted to reach out to you and know more about you?
The easiest way to reach out to me would be through our 800 number, which is 888-444-7237. You can either call me there and leave a message. The other way is through our website, which is mdrealestategroup.com. That's our real estate website. So you can reach out there and find information on us, and you can register there as well.
Perfect. And any last words of advice or anything else you'd like to let the listeners know?
Just do it. Just
awesome.
Do it. You know what? Sometimes I think people, they get maybe a little bit caught up in the numbers and they overanalyze. And, you know, sometimes you just got to get that gut feeling and say, you know what, we're just going to do it.
And that's it.
You know
absolutely.
What? Sometimes you make really good money on a project. Sometimes you don't make as much money. And you learn a ton. So just consider that part of the education curve.
Excellent. Well, thank you very much, Michael. It was a pleasure having you on the show. And I look forward to seeing you at some future real estate investing events.
I hugely appreciate the opportunity, Sarah. And it's been a pleasure to chat with you this evening.
Thanks so much for listening to Where Should I Invest? With your host, Sarah Larby. Make sure to listen in next time. We'll catch you on the next episode of Where Should I Invest?